The views expressed on ExoPolitics Radio with Alfred Weber are the views of Alfred Weber and not specifically those of our on-air affiliates or our sponsors.
Welcome back. This is ExoPolitics Radio, a weekly magazine format public affairs program on exopolitics, the new political science of outer space, the science of relations between our human civilization and other intelligent civilizations in the universe. ExoPolitics Radio is produced by Phoenix Productions of Phoenix, Arizona, and can be heard on 1480 AM KPHX Progressive Talk Phoenix and worldwide on the internet at www.exopoliticsradio.com. Our audio archives, which are increasingly a world and cosmic resource, yes, there are people who write in and say that they continually go back. They have listened to every radio program all three seasons on our audio archives and go back and listen again and again, and have actually gone through and listened three times to every program, are at www.exopoliticsradio.com, and these are open to the public free 24/7. And that's increasingly a very rare commodity, and we are proud at ExoPolitics Radio of making that a reading library available to you, our public. We welcome our listeners once again on Paranormal Radio Network on Mondays at 8 p.m. Central Time, which is now heard in 282 U.S. cities and 92 countries. I'm your ever-present but elusive host, Alfred Weber, and today we're once again in our creative hiatus in Season 3 with our feature interview on exopolitics and orbs with Dr. Michael Ledwith. And today's official exopolitics commentary is on the illusion of extraterrestrial warfare in space. You know, once again, these memes which are being promoted by individuals and then accentuated by the mainstream media. And we were recently forwarded a very interesting observation by a colleague of ours, James Gilliland, of the Eseti Ranch. You can find that at www.eceti.org. And I'm again going to be a speaker this year at the Science, Extraterrestrial, and Transformation Conference at the Trout Lake, Washington Center. That'll be the weekend of July 4th, 2008. And you can find out more about it at www.eceti.org. I believe that Dr. Michael Ledwith will be a speaker there as well. And here is James Gilliland's commentary, and I think it's very important. He says, Alfred, on Sunday, Ed Grimsley. Now, Ed Grimsley is an individual who's online, who self-describes himself as the person who has, quote, been seeing battles between unknown craft in the midnight skies since he was a teenager. Since then, he has continued seeing what appear to be delta-shaped and saucer-shaped aircraft in space, shooting it out using what appear to be laser weapons. Okay, that's how he promotes himself. On Sunday, Ed Grimsley will be on Coast to Coast. That's another radio program. It used to be hosted and was hosted by Art Bell. I'm sure you've heard of it. Now, according to a whistleblower from a top-secret CIA program that we've been working with for a number of years, Art Bell, under his full name, Arthur W. Bell III, he's a linear descendant of Alexander Graham Bell, was an employee of a top-secret CIA program back in the early 1970s. And this was a black budget program, and it was a program that had parts of it in extraterrestrial human liaison, as well as time travel teleportation, so that then Arthur W. Bell III was in full cognizance of the fact that the U.S. government had time travel teleportation and was an extraterrestrial human liaison and had full cognizance of various technological antecedents to remote viewing which are described on the ProjectCamelot.org website, known as the Looking Glass Technology. So in some sense, one can question how the Coast to Coast program came into being and what the connection was between Arthur W. Bell III, CIA employee, and Art Bell, Coast to Coast radio talk show host, and the censorship that you're about to see in this particular item. This is James Gilliland. On Sunday, Ed Grimsley will be on Coast to Coast talking about war in space. Problem is, he was here at the ranch, this is a Trout Lake Ranch, with several pairs of night vision, and I have one of them. We did not see what he was talking about. There were no explosions, laser fires between ships or capsules coming down from ships that were blown apart by F-15s, 16s, or F-15s shooting the capsules. We do see the ships power up on a regular basis as a signal to the people on the ground, yet none of the things that Ed Grimsley saw were witnessed by anyone else. We did see the ships. The night vision works well, but the projection of the observer is what is in question, that is, of Ed Grimsley. We did see a light between ships, which is witnessed by one person at the ranch, but we cannot assume what it was. Could have been communication, transfer of people or cargo with advanced technology, could have been anything, and both ships seemed to go merrily on their way without any evasive maneuvers. I told Ed Grimsley he seems not to project his reality into space or jump to conclusions, especially when we witnessed the very same craft with the very same night vision goggles and did not see any fire between ships, in other words, shooting between ships, explosions, evasive maneuvers, or capsules, only the usually power-ups where the ship gets brighter as they fly overhead. This projection by Ed Grimsley plays into the weaponization of space and the threat program, that is, assuming that ETs are a threat, so that this would set up the need for more exotic weapons, etc., to fend off this illusion or meme of the attacking ETs. Please feel free to comment, call in, or challenge this event. In other words, Ed Grimsley on Coast to Coast. I, in other words, James Gillen, was asked to go on Coast to Coast as well, but when I said I cannot validate his claims or experience due to the fact that in our case it did not happen as he perceived, this led to my instantly being uninvited. It seems that fear, suspense, keeping the threat going is more important than truth. Be well, James Gilliland, www.eseti.org. So, folks, it might be a very popular program with many listeners coast to coast, but understand that the seeds of that program, that is Coast to Coast with Arthur W. Bell III, CIA black budget employee circa 1971 in a secret extraterrestrial human liaison program and time travel teleportation program, one can query how a black budget CIA program then gets to be the host of a very large, with the largest radio audience. That generally is sustained with a lot of CIA power behind it. I've been in radio since the 1980s. One of my radio programs, The Instant of Cooperation, the first live radio program between the United States and the then Soviet Union in history, was nominated for an award on the floor of the General Assembly. And I know that you don't get a 26 million radio audience unless the CIA is behind you. So as far as I'm concerned, Coast to Coast, which was founded by a black budget CIA employee, Arthur W. Bell III, which continues a lot of disinformation, is still suspect. This has been an official Exopolitics Radio commentary. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Please stay tuned for our feature interview with Dr. Michael Ledwith on Exopolitics and Orbs. Thank you.
Exopolitics Radio with Alfred Weber.
Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber, And today we have our very special guest, Michael Ledwith, who was a professor of systematic theology for 16 years at Maynooth College in Ireland and was subsequently the president of the university for 10 years. For 17 years, he served as a member of the International Theological Commission. He has lectured extensively throughout Europe, South America, Japan, Australia, Mexico, and North and South America. His forthcoming book is a three-part work entitled Forbidden Truth. And we have today, Michael Ledwith is with us speaking about the Orb Project. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you so much, Alfred. It's a great honor to be invited on your program today.
Well, you know, I can recall that you and I spoke together at the Trout Lake, Washington conference, I think.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
And where we actually saw a number of orbs. I mean, people were out photographing them. And could you share with our listeners exactly what orbs are?
Well, I think on the basis of 5 or 6 years of photography, and as we shared in conversation just a while back, I probably have the largest collection of orb pictures in the world, and I've done a lot of careful analysis of them in every conceivable arrangement that could be thought of. And basically, I think that what orbs are, if we subscribe to the multi-level universe that is familiar to us from ancient Hinduism and Buddhism and in more modern form from Ramtha's teachings, that the orbs are beings that inhabit regions not distant from us in terms of mileage, but near to us and separated only in terms of frequency. So if we subscribe to a seven-layer universe, separated one level from another by frequency, then the orbs are the beings that inhabit those other six levels above us. And in other words, if you subscribe to the idea that you and I come down here, having lived enormous times in other dimensions, and we come down to inhabit a physical body, then you and I are, I should say, an orb is what you and I are if we did not have the physical body. So, are they extraterrestrials? No, they're interdimensionals, because extraterrestrials, which I have no doubt do exist, there's so much evidence on all sides, for heaven's sake, right now. I mean, what would give us the impression that we were so special that on this rather insignificant planet in the boondocks of the Milky Way, that we would be the only focus of God's care and attention and purpose throughout the millennia? I mean, there's no arrogance to compare with that, I think. So fundamentally, the extraterrestrials, however, are separated from us on this plane of existence, the Hertzian radio microwave frequency we call the Hertzian plane. And the orbs are near neighbors in that, except they're on the other planes above us, the infrared plane, etc. And they're not separated from us by distance at all, but by frequency. And when the digital cameras came into common usage a decade or so ago, they're, of course, able to see into a narrow band of the infrared spectrum just below visible light. And that's where we make our first acquaintances with the orbs. So are they intelligent on the basis of my investigations? Absolutely. Do they respond? Absolutely. So I think, you know, there are times, Alfred, when some discoveries come along, like the discovery of the circulation of the blood or the discovery of the germ theory of disease. It's no longer due to demons or ghosts. It's due to these little microscopic organisms. There are times when the whole view of the world changes, such as when we discovered the Earth was round or whatever. And I think the discovery of the orb phenomenon is one of these, because it's going to revolutionize our whole understanding of where we are in the cosmos and how we relate to other beings that inhabit us with us, and also how we use the cosmos to accomplish what it is we would like to see happen. I'm exploring that in a new DVD I'm bringing out in a couple of weeks called Orbs, Clues to a More Exciting Universe, because I think that's what we're on the verge, really, of discovering.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I'm here with your book, The Orb Project,
uh-huh.
And I'm looking at some of the very handsome photographs in it. Of course, we're a radio medium, but I'm sure that many of our listeners are familiar with what orbs are, and if you go out and take a digital camera, I know that we've done it on our back deck out here on in Vancouver. Canada, mm-hmm. and we've gone out and said, hey, let's go out and have an orbs fest, and we've gone out and photographed, and, you know, lo and behold, you begin to take a look at the photographs, and you see that these sort of round balls of light appear around people's knees and, you know, up around their heads and, mm-hmm. you know, these sort of things, and that they tend to be variable. And then you'll have these really wild ones, like I'm looking at your figure I-42, which looks like an explosion of, almost like a fireworks, you know, of colored lights.
Yes.
And for those skeptics out in the audience that say, you know something, those are just reflections out of the light. Those are dust particles that are being photographed. Those are lint on the camera lens. Those are artifacts of the digital process. Could you just briefly run through all of the typical physical artifacts that could be called orbs, but that we can, from a protocol, laboratory protocol point of view, dismiss as you know, not accounting for the orb phenomenon?
Sure, I certainly would be delighted to do that. Now, first of all, Alfred, I'm not an orb missionary. You know, I'm not on a on a crusade here to convince anyone of anything.
Right.
And I was on live breakfast television on ABC 10 days ago, and I was interviewed by a lady and gentleman, very wonderful interviewers. And, you know, I said, if you're skeptical, I am as skeptical as both of you put together and more so. So I said, when I was getting involved in this, I was not going to go down the garden path, you know, of feeling that this was something wonderful unless I could dismiss any conceivable way that it could be explained in terms other than the orb phenomenon being real. So a lot of the objections that were raised were, you know, it's due to dust particles, it's due to pollen in the air, it's due to something being stirred up in the environment. I think we, especially my colleague Klaus Heinemann, who was an eminent physicist who has worked with NASA, etc., you know, we have looked at all of that, and if you analyze all those theories, it really does not stand up. I mean, there are false orb pictures, there are. But I think, you know, to say that there are some false orb pictures does not dismiss the reality of the vast majority of them. Because if you try to photograph dust particles and you try to photograph pollen in the air and you try to photograph raindrops, etc., you know, you cannot pick up a raindrop unless it's within about 2 feet of the lens. And we have countless thousands of pictures where orbs are actually obscured by an object between them and the camera, which couldn't really account for an origin from dust particles alone. So the dust and the pollen and all that stuff, I really don't think is worth spending too much time on. I have countless pictures where the sky was absolutely empty when I took the first picture. 10 seconds later, which is the amount of time it takes my humble camera to recycle, 10 seconds later the sky is filled with colored orbs. I think I may have that picture in the book, one of them anyway. And 10 seconds later, still, the sky is totally empty again. So within 30 seconds, you have nothing, you have the sky full, and 30 seconds later, you have nothing again. All of the same scene. Now, that on its own, I think, dismisses all those theories that orbs are just dust particles or pollen particles, etc. So I think any fair-minded person won't waste too much time, but I'm glad it's raised because it's obviously an issue we need to look at and address. Now, there are a lot of false orb pictures out there, Alfred, but most of them are not due to dust particles or pollen, etc. They're due to light being reflected down the lens of the camera. If you're too close to a bright light source like the moon or the sun or a street light or even a candle in a dark room, if it's not in the viewfinder, it nevertheless can ricochet down through the lens and leave you with a string of circular shaped images across your picture, which are just replications of the camera circular lens. That's called lens flare, at least I call it that in the book. Now, if you're not careful about keeping your back to a bright source of light, you can get that, and they look like orbs, but they're not, and it's as easy as chalk as cheese to distinguish them. So, I mean, I am grateful that people raise these doubts, but I have no doubt on the basis of 6 or 7 years and 150,000 images subjected to the most rigorous scrutiny, I assure you, and the most skeptical scrutiny, that the orb phenomenon is real.
Right. So what we have is, with the introduction of digital photography, suddenly there's a phenomenon which doesn't appear in all digital photographs, but only some digital photographs.
Right.
You're listening to Exopolitics Radio. We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Alfred Weber, host of Exopolitics Radio. Finis Productions makes my dreams come true on Exopolitics Radio. Let Finis Productions make your dreams a reality. Finis Productions' comfortable studio in Phoenix, Arizona offers an award-winning creative team to script and shoot your video, commercial or documentary, record your album, demo reel, graphics, photos, promotional materials, training projects, infomercials, full-service CD and DVD capabilities, video, stage, voiceover talent, vocal, instrumental, musical performance, DJ live sound, and high-definition video and digital audio recording. Contact Phoenix Productions today at 602-476-1502. That's finisproductions.com. Thank you.
Begin to describe for us, what digital photographs does it appear in? Does it depend on the person, on the consciousness of the person, on the circumstances? What is the relation between either the person taking the photograph, the subject of the photograph? What are the dynamics going on that these orbs begin to appear?
Excellent question. Yeah. Now, first of all, Alfred, I think you need to be careful. If you're interested in this subject and want to take orb pictures, you need to be very careful about the camera you will buy, because orbs are normally seen at first, I stress at first, in the infrared spectrum, the high levels of the infrared spectrum, which is just below visible light. So normally people don't see in that spectrum, though I will explain in a minute how we can begin to do that, because everyone can see orbs with their naked eye. It just takes time to train the brain. And I'll explain how to do that if we have time. So normally, if you take a picture with a digital camera and it's not corrected for the infrared light which the digital camera normally receives, everyday portraits like a family group or a wedding group or whatever will look a little bit washed out because of the infrared light. So camera manufacturers put in a filter to reduce the amount of infrared light coming in. And very often, the more expensive the camera, the more filters they introduce. Now, if you have a lot of filters introduced, obviously, if orbs are seen in infrared, you are going to have a camera that's incapable, a digital camera that's incapable of receiving orb pictures at all. And I have made very expensive mistakes like that myself. So what I would suggest is, if you're going to buy a camera for this purpose, bring your ordinary TV or your digital player remote control, which is normally infrared. Bring your TV remote control to the camera shop. Ask to have a battery put in the camera you're interested in, which of course will endear you forever to the camera salesman, because the batteries are normally in the back room somewhere. And when you turn on the camera, point your TV remote control directly into the lens of the camera and see what happens on the little screen at the back. If your camera is able to receive orbs, you should see a generous bloom of light, which is invisible to the naked eye, coming out the back of your camera. If you only see a little pinprick of light or some small amount of light, move on to the next camera, because for orb photography, that camera will be virtually worthless. So that's the first thing. You should pick your camera carefully. Now, with regard to the conditions, some eminent physicists of my acquaintance have maintained that obviously the frequency of the person taking the pictures does matter. In other words, if you are very, very interested in this phenomenon and you start to take pictures every day, say at the same time, in the same place, and with the same instrument, you sort of attune all of these elements to the orb frequency. And you would probably, after a time spent at this work, you're going to get much, much more exciting orb pictures than someone who dashes out for a few minutes here and there at nighttime. Now also, point number three, everybody can see orbs with the naked eye. Now, that might sound a little bit surprising to most people, but it's a fact, because there is a huge difference, Alfred, between looking at something and seeing. Seeing is a human conscious activity. The same is true with UFOs, for instance. There's a huge difference between looking at a UFO and seeing a UFO. Looking is a neutral exercise. The camera, say, looks at a scene. It records exactly what's out there. When you and I look at the same scene, we don't see exactly what's out there. We see what the brain allows us to perceive. And I'm told by specialists that the brain rejects 90% or more of what we see with the eye. It only concentrates on what's necessary for everyday living, my safety, my health, bringing the children to school, taking out the dog, doing the laundry, and putting out the garbage. Now, orbs don't fit into that. So normally the brain rejects the pictures of orbs. But if you spend a considerable time, and I know this is absolute horror to the instant gratification society to which we all belong, if you spend, say, an hour or two per day at the same time for about 2 years or so, that is how long it took me, photographing orb pictures and analyzing them later, certain surprising things start to happen, and that is that one day, lo and behold, you will start to see orbs with the naked eye. Does that mean you're specially favored by God or that you're a guru or an avatar? No, it simply means you have trained your brain to say, I'm interested in these phenomena and I want to see them, and your brain will oblige.
Right. Now, the experience that we had here in Vancouver was that when we went out on our back deck, or we went out to one of our favorite spots here where we got the better orbs photography, which is Spanish Banks Beach, and we did meditation beforehand, we would find that we got many more orbs.
Right.
Being in a meditative state. Now, the question that I wanted to ask was this. This is Exopolitics Radio. And exopolitics is the science of relations between our human civilization and other civilizations in the universe. So what is the relationship between orbs and exopolitics?
Well, I think it's the next step in exopolitics, if you can pardon me capitalizing on your new word. Because,
please.
I think there's an enormous and a deep connection here. Because I think for the first time in human history, we're at the very beginnings of this science. You know, I often think, Alfred, of the time when the microscope was invented and when physicians were looking down the microscope at samples, say, of blood, and there were chromosomes visible under the microscope. But, you know, it took several weeks before they were able to see them. And you know the old story of the European explorers who went out to the New World, and the natives were not able to see their ships for 3 or 4 weeks. That's the brain filtering again. You know, they couldn't see Columbus's ships, it said, for 3 or 4 weeks. The shamans could see them straight away or almost, and the others followed later. So I think what is opening up here, and this is what I explore in the new DVD, is how we interpret the universe we inhabit and our relationships to other beings that are in there. Because if we're separated by frequency from these orb beings, which after the result of my years of experimentation with them, I am quite confident that they're conscious beings, that they respond instinctively. And I retail in the book, I think, a 5-month period where I had some electronic communication with them. But I think in 20, 25 years from now, we will devise methods of communicating with these beings that will make it commonplace. Just like I remember years ago when my brother came to live in the United States in the 60s, it was almost a preternatural experience to make a life tenfold call from Europe to California at that time. So I think that we're at the very, very primitive stage of communication and awareness with these beings, but they are real, They're just as real as you and I are. It's an exciting prospect. I mean, when I was at the launch of the book in New York on the 7th of November with Simon & Schuster, I gave an hour's talk about orbs, illustrated with slides, etc. And I was amazed at so many people who came up to me and said, my goodness, you know, what you said has given me so much hope and so much comfort to know that I never die, to know that I existed before I came into this physical body, that I am not going to disappear irretrievably when I draw my last breath, and that my loved ones who predeceased me are still not alone, alive and well, but in a better state than we. I mean, what a horrible word we applied to people like that, the dead. The dead, I mean, the dead are far more alive than you and I are, because they're in a higher frequency than we are. So there are many types of orbs. I would classify them as three very crude major categories. Orbs are what we were or are or will be without the physical body. In other words, beings who have decided to take the plunge and be incarnated into physical form, whether it's in a human form, an extraterrestrial form on this same Hertzian plane, or a form that's neither human or extraterrestrial. Then you have orbs who have no intention of ever incarnating in any form on this plane. And you have orbs who have incarnated in, say, subhuman forms or sub-extraterrestrial forms. But basically, they are the majority of what we are. I often think of the human person, Alfred, as something like an iceberg. You know, what is it? One-eighth of it's above the surface, seven-eighths of it are hidden from view. I think what we're called to realize in the opening up of consciousness to the vastnesses and the potentials of the being with which we share this cosmos, we need to waken up the seven-eighths of you and I that are beneath the surface. And if we do, I think, you know, the words of Jesus Christ when he said, if you practice or accept what I teach, you will do all the wonders that I did, and greater indeed than these will you do. It's in the Gospel of John in the New Testament, but we never take it seriously. Now, how do we do these wonders? Well, we do these wonders by wakening up the sleeping giant within, which are the seven layers of you and I that exist beneath the surface. And we've persuaded ourselves, we've got ourselves into a trance of scarcity, that there's only so much to go around. I've got to get it before the other guy does and all that. You know, the universe, its natural state is abundance. And I use an image in the forthcoming DVD, which is, you know, if you look, say, in California at the Colorado River, which flows down through California, and by the time it reaches Mexico, it's almost dried up because so many people have drawn on its water. This is not a good image of the universe. A much better image of the universe, say, is this program we're on right now, or a television program. I mean, if one viewer tunes in his television set to this program, he receives it perfectly well. If a million people tune into it, they receive it equally well. If 100 million tune into it, they receive it equally well. In other words, there is no end to the number of viewers that can view it. And this is how it is with the universe we inhabit if we understand what the orbs are telling us, that it's all based in frequency. The natural state of the world is abundance. And if we can alter frequency, we can alter what it is we wish to experience. This, for me, is the great message of the orb phenomenon, and it's what I explore in the DVD. Because I'm not interested in building up a colossal family photograph of orbs, of which I have more probably than anyone else. I'm interested in what this tells us about our contacts with other intelligent beings that exist in ways that might have been unimaginable even 50 years ago. And exploring the implications of that. It's mind-expanding on a colossal scale, and I think it can only do us as humble human beings enormous good to realize that we live in a realm of abundance, and that the key to it, and the key to harmony, to universal peace, to abundance in joy, lies in understanding the nature of frequency, and the type of frequency we put out is going to attract back to us exactly what it is we exude.
Well, that's very, very eloquently put. The words that come to mind, Michael, to interface it with the extraterrestrial world are those of the Swiss psychologist Carl Jung, mm-hmm. who wrote one of the seminal works, early works in extraterrestrial study, a book called Flying Saucers.
And in that book, which is a classic, he says that flying saucers are mandalas, and that they're, and one of their core functions is to raise the spiritual vibration of humanity. And in fact, if you look at the UFO phenomenon, which began in 1947, as sort of an outreach from upper dimensional ETs toward humanity, its function has been to raise the universal consciousness and the universal awareness of humanity to the fact that, that we live in a wider universe filled with life. And so, and it seems to me that the orb is very much like a UFO phenomenon. It's contact. If we look at the analogy of contact, well, it was through the digital camera. That's how we achieve contact with this new life form.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could comment on that aspect of it, the orb as a UFO.
Well, it is indeed. It's a little more difficult indeed, I suppose, to contact than a UFO. Because UFOs, as I was mentioning earlier in the program, are basically on the same level, the Hertzian level of frequency as you and I are, and everything on that frequency is solid to everything on the same frequency. Now, if we move out into the orb phenomenon, there are no orbs on the Hertzian level of frequency. There are orbs in the neighboring frequency, which is infrared. There are orbs in the visible light frequency. There are orbs in the ultraviolet frequency. There are orbs in the X-ray and the gamma frequency. And we can access each of those. Now, as I said earlier, the digital camera is only able to access orb entities in the higher levels of infrared, in a really narrow band of that. But if you train your brain, you know, over that period, which might seem an eternity to the instant gratification society in which we've all grown and flourished, you will see them with your naked eye, because all it requires is to train the brain to recognize that these are important to you and these are interesting to you. But once you begin to see them with your naked eye, you know that the only difference between me and anyone else in this seven-tiered universe, the only difference is frequency. And if I keep my frequency at the lowest possible level, in other words, if I'm interested in survival, in competition, in hostility, in warfare, in whatever care, if any form of separation that you care to mention, if my frequency is in that polarized frequency, then I am never going to see the wonders that we were born to inhabit and explore.
Now, we're down to the last two or three minutes of this very exciting segment. I mean, the time has just sped forward, but just in these last minutes, what have you found to be the nature of human orb communication?
Well, I found in a way I describe in the book, it's a bit complex to do here in two or three minutes, that I was able to present questions to them, not telepathically, but in, you know, harsh physical reality in terms of instrumentation, and I was able to get a response from them. I conducted this very cumbersome means of communication for about 5 or 6 months, and then they stopped. But I discovered a lot about what the orbs, that particular group of orbs themselves were. I asked them, this was before the Iraqi war, I asked them, you know, about what they saw coming down the timeline towards us, and I think everything that has happened in between then and now has turned out the way that they said it would, which tells me that time is not a linear thing. You know, I often use the analogy, Alfred, of a cassette tape. If I want to play a track 5 on a cassette tape, I've got to fast forward through the first 4 tracks. If I want to go back to track 2, I've got to reverse fast back through tracks 3 and 4. Whereas time seems to me now to be parallel. It's more like a compact disc or a DVD. I can flip tracks instantly. So time seems to be running in parallel, and it's accessible. It's not accessible on the frequency we're in, but if we lift above it, it is accessible. And there's only potentials. There's no such thing as an absolute future. It can always be changed. And I think that's a lesson we really badly need to learn today with the Earth and the many challenges that it's facing at a physical level. Look at the storms. Look at the disasters. They're everywhere. I mean, are we blind when we look at this stuff? But the thing is that the only real answer to this is a change of consciousness. And I think that is one of the main lessons in terms of communication that I have learned. You know, the world, I was on a program with James Gilliland last week, And I said, you know, the world is exactly as we have made it, because it's our trance of scarcity, as I mentioned earlier. It's our conviction of lack. It's our conviction that we need to be competitive. It's our conviction that I need to get it before the other guy gets it. This is what has exactly produced a universe exactly as we have ordered it from the menu. So once we start ordering something different from the menu, then I think we're going to experience a vastly different world. And if we realize, like in the analogy I gave earlier, which is the theme of the DVD, if we realize that there is only abundance there, if we really get it, then I think we're opening ourselves up to a vast experience in the cosmos. And I'm sure that there are many extraterrestrials out there who don't want anything whatsoever to do with us, because we're so primitive and so unevolved. And that is what, if you were asking me what is one last word I would like to leave you with on this program, I would say that. And if anyone has orb pictures or has any questions, obviously we've covered very little ground today, please contact me. Feel free to contact me, at least, on my website, which is hamburgeruniverse.com. Years ago, I was talking about the ways that we're blocked in terms of manifesting the power that Jesus Christ spoke about. And I said, here's the earth in the middle and the vault of the heavens above, where God and the angels and the saints inhabit. And we've the vault of the underworld beneath, where Satan and his minions repose waiting for us if we don't do well. And I said, my goodness me, that looks like a hamburger. So I called my website the Hamburger Universe. But if anyone wants to send me or pictures for a comment on them or some advice or whatever, I would be very glad to receive them at that website, hamburgeruniverse.com.
Oh, well, thank you. And thank you for an insight and for your research and exploration into this new, shall I say, I don't want to say dimension, I want to say this new intelligence, mm-hmm. which is knocking at our walls.
Oh, right.
And wanting to communicate with us and to help wake us up.
Exactly, and, wake us up. That's a great word.
Yeah, and so we look forward with anticipation your new discoveries, and so that we can share them and their relevance to our focus, because I think, as you said, this is within a larger framework that we can call exopolitics, or that we can call whatever our relation is with other intelligence throughout this multiverse. And we really want to thank you for expanding our knowledge and our understanding of this new phenomenon. We've been with Michael Ledwith, who is author of the Orb Project, and we're very grateful that he has joined us. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Please stay tuned.
Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Well, it looks like we have a program that has gone the full spectrum from the upper dimensional, life-affirming, the new popping through in terms of the orbs, and the old, coast-to-coast, founded by a black-budget CIA operative, Arthur W. Bell III, who was such in 1971, and propelled by the CIA and the black budget into a 20 million plus listener program now, which, according to the testimony of James Gilliland, is continuing to promote the view of the evil ETs and the weaponization of space vis-a-vis the Ed Grimsley. And when James went on to give testimony that would have undercut that, well, he was instantly disinvited. And that's the thing about Exopolitics Radio. We really tell it like it is. And you'll find out things here, insights that you will not find elsewhere. And that's our purpose, really, to be journalists of the new political science of outer space, journalists of relations between our human civilization and other intelligent civilizations in the universe. Exopolitics Radio is produced by Phoenix Productions in conjunction with 1480 KPHX Progressive Talk Phoenix, executive producer Richard Romero Sr., director Arvi Romero, producer and editor Chris Romero. I'm your host, Alfred Weber, wishing you a wonderful, miracle-filled, and shall we say, coast-to-coast, bamboozle-free day, week, and life. Thank you.